Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cannibalizing the Canon, episode 45, Good Rewine and Other Magical Meals. I am V/Fella/Rin/3DogsInATrenchcoat. Woof, woof, woof.
And I am Glaive. Or Danny, or whatever the heck you want to call me.
I love that even though you weren't doing the intro, you were still committed to the voice.
Oh, know? Of course.
Got it.
I have to. It's how we get the energy up.
Hey, you know what another way of getting energy up is?
What's that?
Food!
Oh my god.
That's what I'm going to be talking about.
What a transition.
It's not my best transition, but I'm still working on that one.
All them segues.
Yeah, I want to talk about food. Not just because I fucking love food.
Hey. Disclaimer for this episode, go eat something.
please go eat something. I'm doing this on an empty stomach, and that's going to be my first big mistake.
I'm also doing this on an empty stomach.
We didn't think this through. We should have got food first. Anyway, food. Food is one of those things that is universally important, not just because we need it to survive, but in terms of culturally, food has always been kind of the centerpiece of bringing people together. Go on.
It's interesting because, like, technically speaking, as a culture, humans could have just been like, there we go. Is it edible? Good. There, that's the end of discussion. But, like, we didn't because we're human. We were just, no. We're going to put some spices on this shit.
Disclaimer, not as white bitches, let's be real.
No, but you know, even with
spice and went ooh.
With the quote unquote white bitches, there's still like a lot of variety.
Yes. For a minute then I thought you were gonna say pumpkin spice counts. No, it doesn't, friends. Pumpkin spice doesn't count. Get out of here. Anyway. Yeah, no, very much so. Like, we could have just gone, hey, it's edible, it gives us energy, done. But we made a big spectacle of it. We make these, grand meals, and we insist that people sit down together and eat together.
Mm.
It's very much like just this thing that we do to kind of keep in touch with each other and you know, almost check in with each other. It's just like, hey, let's sit down, let's have a meal together, let's talk.
It reminds me, funnily enough, there's a very recent book, Project Hail Mary. I've mentioned it before. I believe I did an episode, a review on it.
You did. It was one of our first cannibals, I think.
And one of the scenes in that book has the alien character, Rocky, be very uncomfortable being watched eating food. Because to it, it's like, no, this is a private matter. The equivalent of watching someone take a leak. Mm-hmm. It's like, what are you doing right now? Like, I'm socializing.
Yeah, it's in a book that I have read and will spout about for forever. A Psalm for the Wild Bill. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I was trying to remember which one it was mentioned at first. Sees a monk meet a robot for the first time in a very, very, very long time. And the robot is trying to understand humans and what it is that humans need. And the discussion of food and meals come up. And for the human, it is rude to not offer a plate to someone who is sitting with them. But the robot doesn't consume the food. So it's essentially just a second. They work it out. It's fine. It's a second portion for me. Just go with it. Okay. but it's very much, it's ingrained in us as humans to it's one of our love languages is feeding each other. It's just like, please take this food. The amount of times that like I've gone to someone's house and they've been like, have you eaten? You know, just like come and sit down, just have a sandwich or something, please. I will make you something. I'll fix you something up.
This is what makes my life complicated because I'm such a fussy git that I tend not to accept the social standard of like, here's some food. And I'm like, cool. I don't want to eat this, but thank you.
Meanwhile, there's me who's just like, yeah, put just keep going. I will accept all of the social stuff. Like, this is why, like, we need to travel around together, because then you can accept it and I can just eat it. It's great. I'm just going to be rolling around. I'm going to put on so much. It's going to be great. Anyway, it's very much ingrained into who we are as people. And yes, absolutely. It's not, it varies from culture to culture. Like, the family meal is pretty much a staple in a lot of cultures, but it varies on how that looks. Like, for me, a family meal is me and whoever lives in the house with me at the time. So, you know, in the past, it would have been my parents, my brother. For some of my friends, a family meal is their immediate family and then the extended family who live close by. They would gather and have a large meal, you know, and make a big spectacle of it. And that's just how they do. That's just what their family gatherings are like. Mm. And I think in terms of D&D, when you are world building, it is always a good consideration to think, okay, how do these people approach meals? How do they approach coming together over food? Because everyone does, unless you're an alien, in which case, you know, you go into a special room for that, apparently. Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. Like, so then I was thinking, like, what is it, like, an ancestry that's in D&D that would, like, fit that description of, like, non-social food consumption? And the only thing that comes to mind would be one of the, like the mind flayers. But, like, it's less of a, it's not a social thing, and it's more of a, they eat the brains.
I mean, I was gonna say, by definition, it's a little social.
Yeah,
at least at the start. It's a very lonely activity after a certain period, but you know. I actually take that aspect. I have a sect in my homebrew game. I have a sect of mind flayers who will only go after people who are dying. And only with consent, right? Like, they're very upfront about who they are, and they try and do it as painlessly as possible, and it's a whole thing. And in a way, they've kind of made it, because they have to have that level of, like, consent and agreement and discussion, they have made it a very social thing. Now that I think about it, I think this says a lot about me as a person. Anyway, we don't have time to unpack all that. We got to talk about magical food. So,
magical food.
Well, food, let's start with fruit before we make it magical. Let's start with the basics. when you are talking about food in D&D, where do you start? There's two main things you need to look at when you're talking about food. The description of it and the reaction to it.
Mm.
So when it comes to describing food, here's the thing. I am not great at descriptive stuff. I'm just not. Like, it's frustrating, because as a DM and as a writer, I want to be really good at that. I want to be on those levels of just being able to, like, rattle off this beautiful monologue describing a single tower in the distance of a wasteland, right? I can't do that. That's not who I am as
a
person.
You just did it.
No, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know.
Like, the language that goes with that, hand in hand. Like, I can state that there is a thing over there, but I'm not good at describing what that thing looks like, what emotions that thing might, you know, bring forward. Like, I'm not good at that. Unless it's food.
Unless it's food.
I am great at describing food. I described an apple pie, and boy howdy, everyone in the room was like, God damn, that sounds really good. I'm like, yeah, right? Delicious. And there's two reasons for that. One, I fucking love food. And two, when I think about describing food, I think back to food I have eaten. And I can't always do that when I'm describing other things, because I don't know if I've seen a tower in the wasteland before. I don't know if I felt those emotions that adventurers might be going through. but I know what it's like to eat a really good burger. And I am going to talk about that. That's what I do. Like, this might be part of my neurodivergency, but in terms of, like, bringing experiences back to the common ground that I have with them, which is my experiences, plays heavily into why I describe food the way that I do.
Right, but that also plays into what I've said many, many, many times about how, like, it doesn't matter, like, if you've played D&D before, it's always going to be different depending on who's running it, because everyone has their own perspective and they're going to have their own strengths and weaknesses and the way they do things.
Absolutely.
I'm curious, before we get really into, like, how we go about describing food.
Sure.
Where would you consider your, like, ability to visualize things? Like, you're saying you have difficulty, and I know this is off topic, but, you know, this is a podcast.
Okay, we're teaching V how to imagine. Okay, the thing is, I'm very good at, like, for me, when it comes to imagining things and visualizing things, I can do that in my mind's eye. Mm-hmm. It's just, I can't always translate that into the words of how I describe a thing.
It's specifically sometimes, the word part.
Yeah, there's a disconnect between part. Between the picture and the words. And if I was, you know, if I had decided to go and pursue art in the way that I ended up pursuing words, I might have a better time of it because I might be able to draw that shit out. I say might because I know that's not always a thing. Like, it's not always one or the other. Sometimes you can't do either because your brain just doesn't make that connection properly. And that's fine. That's just part of being human. But yeah, I just have this, sometimes it just doesn't quite connect properly. Sometimes it does. And like, it does, it tends to focus around food because, again, I cannot stress how much I fucking love food. But sometimes it happens with the weirdest things. Like, there are certain scenes where, like, if I have a particular emotion attached to it, I will then be able to describe that wonderfully.
Yeah,
or like, if it's something that I've invested in, like, if I've invested in a scene emotion, like, heavily, like, if it's a whole piece that I'm bringing to the table, I will knock it out of the park. A lot of the time, the disconnect comes from if I'm having to ad-lib it.
Right.
I think. But that is my whole DM style. Oh, God. I've set myself up for failure here. But yeah, no, there's a disconnect sometimes. And a lot of the time it comes when describing something.
Yeah, but it's the difference between reality and fantasy. Like, so I find that partially it's because, like, just brains work different. Everyone's brain works their own way. So, like, I have a very large GM canon that I can draw from, so that when I am describing things, I'm not just describing things out of the blue. I'm describing things from what I've read or seen before, like all the books I've, like, crammed in there. I'm not making the description up on the spot. I'm stealing descriptions of other things, and then
I do think that's a big difference as well, because as well, you know, the pool of things that I have consumed is, it's not great.
It's limited.
We're working on it, but it's limited. But yeah, as a result, like I know that in games in the past where you've been describing something and someone's not quite been getting what you're picturing, you'll say, hey, do you remember that scene in this?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go, oh, I know what you mean now. Yes, yeah. I'm there. I can't always do that because I haven't seen the thing and the stuff, you know?
But because you can do things like, it's easy to describe food that you have actually eaten and seen and such, like a donut, for just off the top of my head.
Wow, why you gotta be like this? I'm kidding.
But then if you have to describe, say, a sword, like, I've never held an actual real sword.
Like real sword in this economy?
Like an actual metal killer guy sword. I have not wielded one. That'd be a great thing to do at some point. That's a bucket list item.
it's on the list. It's on the bucket list.
But I've read enough and I've seen enough to know, like, they don't go swing when they come out of the holster like they do in the movies. And they're quite heavy. And I know they're shiny most of the time, sometimes, depending on the sword.
I know you have to look after them and maintain them. And yeah, I know that there's a whetstone involved.
Exactly.
And I know that, you know, whilst they have a physical weight to them, often there will also be an emotional weight to them, depending on the character.
The balance itself, just like, oh, it's weighted for the person who's using it.
Exactly. Like, and I know these things, and it then makes it easier to describe those things. Like, I'm not terrible at describing swords.
Mm-hmm.
Because I attribute that solely to The Princess Bride.
Yeah.
That's my sword knowledge right there. And it's fucking served me well all these years.
So then, in regards to food.
Yes.
You have a framework.
I do. Yeah. Here's the thing. The food is following a pattern when it comes to describing food. Because there's three things you really need to focus on when you're looking at food. It's three senses. It's genuinely just boils down to these three things, and it's ridiculous because you can add extra things, but if you take away any of these things, it takes away from the power of the image, because food is heavily based on three senses: your sense of smell,
yep,
your sense of taste, mm-hmm, and your sense of sight. Because taste, you look
I
at
think
it,
is the number one.
Yeah. Well, you look at it and you go, hey, that's food. And you smell it and your brain goes, hey, that's delicious food. And then you taste it and you go, actually, this is hot garbage. No, I'm kidding. But also, in addition to taste, taste is kind of twofold, because it's the taste of something, but it's also the texture of something.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't need to worry about that until they actually eat it. Which,
the tactileness is like, you know, an aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. Generally, the first thing that you will want to describe is the sight, what it looks like visually. And in terms of like whether something is a particularly good example of what it is. So, for example, if I was talking about a pie, let's keep going with this apple pie, because I really want apple pie now, though. I have shot myself in the foot. I'm so hungry for pie. If you're talking about a pie, you say, oh, okay, so it's a slice of pie with crust on the top, made out of pastry. Cool, great. Does it look like good pastry? Does it look particularly flaky? Does it look like it's got, you know, the egg wash sheen on the top that you come to expect from, you know, good pastry?
Mm-hmm.
What about the filling? Is there a good pastry to filling ratio? Is it a deep dish pie? Like, you don't have to answer these questions with this kind of analyticalness. You don't have to go to the place, hey, this is a deep dish pie with a ratio of like 6 to 1. It's, you know, you don't have to get into that kind of level of detail, but knowing that information and kind of going, okay, so this is a good, well-filled pie. There's a lot of, the apples look really well tender. The pastry kind of crumbles as the knife cuts into it. And as it's served, the filling stays pretty solid, but you can just see like the sweet sugary juices kind of dripping off the end of the knife. That already, I'm so hungry already for that piece of pie. I am just starving now. Fuck.
Why have I pissed myself? Before we go on, though, I feel like, and we're going to probably, this is probably what you're going to be talking about next, but I'm just going to put out, because I'm sure there's people listening right now and being like, okay, sure, it's all well and good to have like a system in which we describe food, but why are we describing food? Like, well, in the grand scheme of things,
absolutely.
Yeah.
You don't have to describe your food. You can say, hey, there's a feast on the table. Go.
That's an apple. Wild. Deal with it.
I didn't even make you a pie. Fuck off. Yeah.
But here's the thing, lads. Here's the weird thing, the magical power of GM description. When you describe something, it's important, because GMs don't describe things that aren't like irrelevant most of the time.
Caveat to that. If it's food, I'll describe it every time, whether it's important or not. No, okay, so here's the thing.
Depending Isn't it George R.R. Martin that has like pages full of food descriptions?
Oh my god, am I George R.R. Martin? Fuck my life! Anyway, god, the last thing I want to be told that I'm a cis white man. Anyway, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. Food in a game can be a powerful tool because, number one, and you should always start with this, the fae.
Oh, 100%.
Don't. I know it looks delicious. I know your GM has just described to you a whole platter of food. Don't fucking eat it. Don't fucking do it. And here's where you can get them, because you can be like, oh yeah, no, there's a fruit bowl laid out. You can see like the grapes there, you know, like they're glistening in the light. They just look really plump. And are they seedless? Oh damn. And then look at that apple. You've never seen an apple look so good. It's like ambrosia, you know, like you can really like tempt players with that.
Mm.
But also too, having those moments of kind of appealing to not necessarily the character's humanity, but the player's humanity. Mm-hmm. It's enticing them to get involved in whatever the food is the center of, whether that is a feast. I almost said a feast for crows. Fuck. God damn it, George R. R. Martin. Whether that's a feast where you guys are the guests of honor, whether that's peace talks, whether that's just you've been invited into the home of the big bad, you know, food really sends a message. And how you describe that food and how appetizing and appealing that food is really sends a message to the characters and to the players. And that's the second thing you need to think about when it comes to describing food, is what reaction you want that food to give your players. Usually it's either going to be you want them to remember something like a deep, like a core memory, or like to like think of that scene in Ratatouille where the mm-hmm. critic eats the ratatouille and not the rat, the actual food, and then suddenly is transported back to when he was a kid and his mum makes him ratatouille and he just has that like, you know, core memory activated kind of moment. And then he's like, oh my god, this food is delicious. And then he finds out it's a rat and the whole thing's a fucking state. Anyway, tapping into those kind of like... And here's the thing, that scene is distinctly French because... And it's not even because like it is definitely a set in France, but in terms of like the memory that it activates is very much a like you come home to your little kind of more rural house. Your mother is home. She's been cooking this vegetable based dish all day. It's just, you know, and just ratatouille is not in my particular childhood memory set.
Right.
Because I am English. And that's not to say I've never had ratatouille. That's just that my cultural mindset is roast dinner. That's a core memory.
That's the equivalent.
Right? It's exactly. So when you are kind of describing these things to your players, think about their characters and what their cultural touchstones are. Because it might not be apple pie. It might be trifle, blancmange. It might be just a simple bowl of fruits. Whatever is going to make them think of the thing that you want them to think about.
Mm-hmm.
You might want the food to evoke an emotion. It might be a show of power. You might get all of this grand food on a table and be like, hey, look at all this power that we've got in this time of like economic uncertainty for the rest of the world. Imagine doing that in this economy. Anyway, but having like your big bad put on a lavish feast whilst his people are starving, or the reverse, going to an NPC's house and them having like, you know, 3-day old bread, some cheese, like the last bits of meat that they've got, but they're giving it to you because although, yeah, times are hard, they recognize that you guys are here to help. And they want to do the best they can for you. Kind
it
of
and provides and context.
It's context. And that's what emotion you are trying to evoke there. And whether that's, you know, envy or whether that's understanding or whether that's, you know, just in my case, fucking hunger. I'm just so hungry for pie.
Like when you were mentioning like extravagant meals, for some reason my brain just went like, is there a dish? Is there a dish that uses horse? I'll get to my point. Is it like, is that mutton or is that something else? No,
that's mutton is sheep.
Okay. So what do you call like horse?
generally the last resort.
Right, okay.
Because
horses aren't as good meals because they're better resources. Yeah,
because they're very good at like carrying us and carrying our stuff. Horses tend to be more of a last resort meal because horses are working animals.
Yeah.
As opposed to food animals. It's for the very, very similar reasons that we don't eat dog that often.
Yeah.
You know, it's dogs are working animals traditionally, and less so nowadays, obviously. But you still have working dogs who like are hunting dogs, and horses fall into the same category. So, yeah, and again, cultures may vary, but it's not something that I think there is a market for in at least in my country. I think
it's just called horse meat. It's more Eurasia, apparently, according to Wikipedia. Is hunted as a source of protein. My point, though, is that an example of extravagance would be quite simply unicorn. Imagine coming into a noble's like grand hall, and in the centerpiece of it is just a unicorn. It's like, oh fuck. Oh boy, this is a bad dude off the bat. Because
I mean, I'll give him this. It comes already essentially pre-spit roasted. I'm going to hell for that one. Anyway,
no, you're not. Absolutely. Unicorns are real.
but yeah, no, absolutely. Like, think about the fantasy creatures that, I mean, that's an episode in itself.
Yeah,
fantasy creatures, sure, and what they taste
that,
like.
That's a whole different thing. We'll get into that. Like,
back to that, trust me. But few, in terms like, of like
bears and abominable snowmen and like,
I got it.
Where's the line?
If you want, I can go through the entire monster manual and give you an edibility rating.
Oh boy, I mean, like, any everything that comes to mind, and I don't.
I'm going to be real though. That's content that y'all are going to have to pay for through our.
We're still doing it. Something I don't think you're going to be talking about it this time, but we should do an episode on it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Specific cultures within ancestries in D&D and what their diets would be like. So like dwarves and elves and dragonborn and all them, like how would they go about and what would their traditions be specifically, because I think that'd be an interesting discussion as well.
It's something that I do actively want to talk about. It was something that I thought about mentioning in this, but I decided we're leaning heavily into the magical stuff on this one, so it wasn't going to come up. But I have a series of pictures on my hard drive somewhere that I shamelessly stole from the internet and will find sources for. Apologies, internet. Of adventurers' ration packs and what they look like depending on their ancestry. Because that's obviously really they look very different for a drow than they would for a dwarf, kind of thing.
I mean, drows have a lot of mushrooms.
Mushrooms and wine. That's pretty much it. I'm like, I could live that life. Let's go. But yeah,
so there's an aspect of that. So like elves, traditionally, a lot of like fantasy elves are assumed to be vegan
vegetarians at least.
Yeah,
it's a big thing, and it's something I do want to kind of look into and dive into more, but not today.
Not today. The last thing I'll say about it, because we will talk about this, we'll have a full episode. The difference between the elven diet and the Feywild diet, because I feel like there could be a connection there between the fact that like the Feywild is still omnivorous.
The way you say the Feywild diet makes it sound like some kind of fad.
I know, right?
You wouldn't believe just how much weight I lost on the Feywild diet.
Christine basically disappeared entirely after 2 days.
I was going to say, technically, the Feywild diet for me is not eating anything anyone offers me.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good diet, actually, when I think about it.
Yes, yeah, that's a calorie intake control right there.
The last thing you might want food to evoke is desire. And I don't mean breaking it down sensual style. I mean, like, it might be a desire to have that much power. It might be a desire to help someone because they have given you everything they have. It might be a desire to get the fuck out of there because this food looks suspicious. It might be something that you want to evoke. Who is swayed by that and what sort of desire that ends up looking like, you tailor it to your party, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know, you might want to evoke like some kind of sensual feelings through your choice of food. That is very much think about it. First date material is going for dinner. Like, that's a thing that people do, you know. We connect over food. We connect over food, and that is what, how we, you know, that's a huge part of being human. So, or in this case, elven.
Anyway.
So, we know how to talk about food.
Yes.
Right? How do we make that magical? Because that's what we're really looking at here, is magical food, right? We're talking your lambus bread. We're talking your cauldron cakes. We're talking about Goodberry wine, which is a thing, I promise we're getting there. To make it magical is really simple.
Mm-hmm.
Just say, hey, it does this to you. But don't just say it like that, obviously. Like, if you want something to get, so you could have a food item that gives you a boost to your con stat, for example.
Yeah.
You could say, okay, yeah, you eat that, it's delicious, take a +1 to your con until your next long rest.
Yeah. Status buffs.
And that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, by the way. You can absolutely describe things like that if that's what you are comfortable doing, 100%.
That's how you do it. That's how you do it.
Exactly. Or. You could say, you take a bite out of this burger. The meat just like falls apart in your mouth, and the bread is soaked up the juice, and it's just like deliciousness happening. It's like a party going on in there, and it's great. And you feel like this is hearty food. This is food that is going to get you through the winter. You physically feel just a little bit like you can take on the world today. Take a con boost. Like you can just eat, like how that food makes them feel is the stat boost, basically.
Yeah.
It
reminds me of there is an Irish myth about what is it? The salmon of knowledge. This is an Irish myth. Have you heard about the myth of the salmon of knowledge?
I have heard of the salmon of knowledge. Do you know how I've heard of the salmon of knowledge?
Because I've told you.
No, because of Douglas Adams and the Salmon of Doubt.
Yep.
but I'm sure many of our listeners have not, so please continue.
So Finn McCool, famous Irish legendary hero,
absolute lad,
one of our, like, you know, equivalents of like Perseus or Heracles or whatever, whoever you'd think, like another one would be Cú Chulainn. But Finn McCool is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was a lad, one of the things that he did was he came across an old man. And this old man was trying to catch the salmon of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Because by eating it, he would be granted all the knowledge. He'd be like all wisdom stats out the wazoo, basically. Uh-huh. He caught it with some help from Finn McCool.
Amazing.
And he's just cooking it. Uh-huh. And he's like, And this is Danny's version of the story. This isn't the actual legend. This is Danny's version. He's just like, hey, I got to take a leak. You stay here for 2 seconds. Don't eat it. He goes out, takes a leak.
Right.
Finn McCool's just sitting there looking at the salmon on the spit roast there, just going, yep, I'm not going to eat it.
I'm not going to do it.
Sizzle off the salmon, goes on to Finn McCool's thumb, burns like, ah, fuck, and he just sucks his thumb, and that's enough.
Oh, okay. So wait, so is it like the first person to take a bite?
Yep.
And then the knowledge is gone. Yep. So now it's just a regular salmon.
Yep.
Oof. Oof.
So let me read the whole thing here, because I have it open. But yeah, the poet Finn McCaeus or Finnegas spent 7 years fishing for the salmon. Finally, Finn caught the salmon and gave the fish to Fionn. This is Finn McCool.
Mm-hmm.
He's servant and son of Cumhail, that however you pronounce it, I don't care. With instructions to cook it, but on no account eat any of it.
Uh-huh.
Finn cooked the salmon, turning it over and over, but when he touched the fish with his thumb to see if it was cooked, he burnt his finger on a drop of hot cooking fish fat. Finn sucked on his burnt thumb to ease the pain. Little did Fionn know that all the salmon's wisdom had been concentrated into that one drop of fat. When he brought the cooked meal to Finn X's, his master saw that the boy's eyes shone with a previously unseen wisdom.
Sure. Sure.
Finnegas asked Fionn if he had eaten any of the salmon. Answering no, the boy explained what had happened. Finnegas realized that Fionn had received the wisdom of the salmon, so he gave him the rest of the fish to eat. Fionn ate the salmon and in so doing gained all the knowledge of the world. For the rest of his life, Fionn could draw upon this knowledge merely by biting his thumb. The deep knowledge and wisdom gained from the salmon knowledge allowed Fionn to become the leader of the Fiona, the famed heroes of Irish myth. So amazing. He just needs to suck his thumb a bit and then, ah, yeah, I got it, guys. It's cool.
Phenomenal. I mean, there are a bunch of, like, myths surrounding food.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and apps, that is something that you should probably consider when world building as well, is, like, when you're coming to build up your mythos. I actually have a list of some interesting things here. Artichokes. Artichokes are big in Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Cyrana was this beautiful mortal girl that Zeus came across during a trip. Fucking Zeus, this guy. This fucking, you know it's gonna be a Zeus myth at some point. And he took her to Olympus and made her a goddess, because that's how it works, you know.
Oh, sure.
Sure, it's classic Zeus. And then she decided, I need to go visit my mom and, like, let her know I'm okay. So she snuck out for a little weekend visit with her mom, and he got super mad about that, threw her off Olympus, and turned her into an artichoke.
Cool.
As a result, first century Romans believed that parts of the artichoke could help cure baldness and even aid with the conception of boys, and was heavily rumored to be an aphrodisiac. And in France, there was a huge ban on women eating artichokes for a very long time because of the sexual power of artichokes, which is not a sentence I ever thought I'd have to say out loud with my own mouth.
So salmon increased wisdom. Artichokes increased charisma. Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Cucumbers, traditionally, in the Roman Empire, they were used to promote fertility. Nobody surprised. Women would wear them around their waist, just wanging them around, you know? just gotta.
I see you have your business cucumber on. Yes, I'm glad you noticed.
Absolutely. Onions were related to eternal life in Egyptian mythology because of their concentric layers. And they would bury their pharaohs with them. They would also shove them in various body parts of mummies, like the pelvis. They would just find an onion there. That's just how they prepared the dead. There was a belief that these like bulbs of deliciousness would bring breath back to the deceased. I mean, they have, it's this is a fact, onions do have antiseptic properties, and it may have been that, not quite understanding this power, they decided that this power was divine and just was like, oh, that'll help you in the afterlife, have an onion up your ass, you know? Like, who are we to question the Egyptians?
Modern civilization.
Yeah, absolutely. To the Aztecs, corn was not just a food source, but it was synced. They believed that the growth and harvest process was synced with the cycle of life, birth, regeneration, and death. They had three female deities of maize to represent each part of the cycle. You know, food has always been kind of tied into religion, mythos.
Yeah.
You know, and absolutely you should lean into that. Fucking just try not to make everything sexual. You know? Please. please. I'm asking you. Also, poppy seeds. This is a fun one. We're all aware poppy seeds and opium are a thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all know that. In ancient Greece, the poppy was a representative of Hypnos, the god of sleep, and was thought to aid sleep. But also, it was slightly associated with Hades, representing an eternal sleep. In the Middle Ages, poppy cake was used by young women to determine the direction from which their one true love would turn up. A young woman would throw a piece of poppy cake out the door and have a dog fetch it. The direction from which the dog returned would be the same as that from which her true love would appear. I feel like the dog's involved like a little bit more than the cake is, but okay, sure.
Poppy seeds also play. What is the logic on that on the other end, though? Like, okay, let's assume for a second, like, oh, it's real. That's how that works. Is the dog actually involved in the process, or is it just fate playing a hand? Because is it like the dog going, oh, this is a poppy cake. Got it. Gotcha. Right. All right. Which way is this bastard meant to be showing up? From the southeast? There's no doors on the southeast.
I love the idea of a dog just out there with a compass, just like, yeah. Where am I going? All right, cool. Poppy seeds, eating sweetbreads with poppy seeds on New Year's Eve, it was believed to aid in abundance for the year to come. But poppy seeds put in the bottom of a bride's shoes would result in infertility. Poppy seeds, man.
Now I'm just imagining some ill-intentioned asshole trying to make a bride infertile by putting poppy seeds in her shoes. Like, yes, I got it now. She won't continue the line. Like, all right, bud. Okay.
But also, I mean, one of the simplest ones, throwing salt over the shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, the it's the little things that really kind of, like, flesh out a world. And so, you know, for your consideration, food. Other ways you can make it magical. So you might decide that you don't want this cake to give you a stat boost. You might want it to do something really silly. Like, you might want it to make you float for 1d4 minutes. Because, you know, why not? A cake is light and airy. It's delicious.
What is it?
Go full Alice in Wonderland with this shit. Like,
I'm also thinking of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, the lemonade stuff. Yeah, absolutely. It's all in how you describe. Like, you can absolutely just say, okay, this food is great, and also it makes you resistant to poison for a day. Or you could describe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give them a kind of sense of how that makes them feel, what it might, you know, make them think is going on in their body.
Right.
Don't get into, like, IBS levels, but, like, you know, talk about, like, how a food might make them feel after eating it. If you decide that, you know what, I like magical food, I love this idea, but I want to just steal some. That's what we're here for, cannibalizing the canon. So you can steal ideas wholesale.
Cannibalize some canons.
Do it. Where can you get magical food from? there are some really obvious candidates that we've already mentioned. Lord of the Rings has quite a few descriptors of food, including Lembas bread. Everyone's favorite Lembas bread, which doesn't look like bread, which always bothered me a little bit. I don't know why. I think in my head, bread should look like bread, you know? But in the movie, it doesn't. It looks like a
pastry.
It looks like a shortbread, which yeah. I guess is still a bread.
It's still a bread.
Yeah, it's, you know, the concept of if you were going to put Lembas bread into Dungeons and Dragons, for example, you could say that it works essentially the same as a Goodberry. It gives you one hit point, and also you don't have to eat for the rest of the day. Done. Job's good. It's great. Maybe don't let your halfling friends eat four.
The thing I want to say about Lembas bread is it kind of shows the difference between humans and elves in a way, because like only elves would come up with food like efficient, like, ha, eat a bite and we're done. And the humans are like, well, okay, cool.
I gotta finish my plate. Are you kidding
me? I wanna eat more though.
It's the difference between elves who eat for energy and
humans who want to enjoy their food. Eat
for joy, yes, absolutely. The magic world that I'm gonna have to say the name, Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Harry Potter has a lot of magical food in it, and, mm-hmm. and a lot of these are kind of like silly harmless effects. You know, you wouldn't necessarily count them as stat boosts, but can be very silly and very fun nonetheless. Absolutely cannibalize that canon the further we get it away from the writers.
You gotta cannibalize all that canon, because only you can tell TERFs to fuck off.
Exactly. I want that as a t-shirt. That Smokey should be a t-shirt. Only you can. Absolutely. And you can find lists of that kind of stuff online, 100%. Another great place, and this is one that I really wish I hadn't come across in some ways, Genshin Impact. Right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, stick with me here, because this is a bit of throwing people for a loop.
I do want to, before you get in there though, is like, tangent to that is Breath of the Wild.
Yes.
For the absolutely. Same reasons.
I mean, yeah, in any fantasy game that has a cooking element, steal that. Just take it. Just fucking go hog wild with it. So in Genshin Impact, there is a essentially a cooking minigame where you cook various things using items that you find. And each food will give you a different benefit. So whether that's improving your stamina, whether that's giving you buffs to your attacks, to your defense, whether it's just a healing food, whether it's a resurrection food. Like, if you fall in battle, you can eat this. And someone shoves it down your throat as you're, like, dying on the battlefield. Just eat this stick, goddamn. And you're miraculously back on your feet. And I'm going to be real. Visually, a lot of this food is fantastic. Oh, it looks so good. But it's really good in terms of, like, A, describing it, because you have a visual reference. But B, all of these foods have something attached to them. Like I say, whether that's a stat boost or whether that's healing, that is something that you can just wholesale pick up and run with.
Mm.
So you can be like, oh yeah, this dew dipped shrimp. Wow, try saying that fucking three times. I don't know what it is, but I can tell you that it looks delicious. It's basically tempura fried shrimp. Right, but they've dipped it in the juice of a flower to make it fancy, and it increases strength. So if I was going to make that in D&D, I'd be like, okay, so it gives you a strength boost. Or you could say specifically it gives you a boost to any athletics checks if you wanted to get real specific.
You could also very easily, hey, cannibalize Popeye and be like, ah, a can of spinach.
Hey, any spinach dish instantly gives you a huge boost to strength. That's just facts. That's just facts, right?
I eat me spinach.
Any game where you have like a cooking mechanic. So yeah, Breath of the Wild, which I probably would have remembered, except for the fact that I have not played Breath of the Wild. I played half an hour of it, and then it bugged out, and I rage quit. I want to play it so bad, but I just can't get over that one bit. Anyway, another one, which I'm going to be real, I think everyone should have one of these books in their home, is a fictional cookbook. And I don't mean a cookbook of recipes you can't make. I mean a book of recipes that you absolutely can make that are based in a fantasy setting. For example, D&D have a cookbook out called Hero's Feast.
Nice.
Where you can make any one of like a 100 odd recipes that are designed to be things you would find in a D&D setting. They also have drinks in there, like cocktails, which is bonkers to me. But they've got stuff like drow mushroom steaks, homelet golden brown roasted turkey, hogs in bed rolls. That's pigs in blankets, you and me. Don't fucking fool me, wizards. Swear to God. Bitopian shepherd's bread. Rations, which I love, by the way. Moonshay seafood risotto. Like, just, you know, regular meals that you can actually cook. But it's a really good way of getting names of things for if you're running a tavern and you need a menu, just pull up a list from that. There is one book I would like to bring to everyone's attention, and it is called The Necronomnomnomicon.
The Necronomnomnomicon?
It is recipes based on the rites and lore of Lovecraft. And whilst we said last week, Lovecraft is a dick, this food is delicious. From such appetizers as sunken moo, sacrificial lamb, and atluck nachos, deep fried deep one, moon beast pies,
deep one is great.
Shark pockets.
What are shark pockets?
Calzones.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Plus, I'll be real, the description in this cookbook is fantastic. What you need: butter, dough of pizza, tomato sauce with meatballs, slices of pepperoni thick and quartered, shredded mozzarella and shredder. The shape of things to yum is how it describes the bit where you do it. On a flat metal sheet, which you buttered up good, shape some raw dough into a shapeless shape. All the parts of the shape should be wide enough for what comes next. Spread some of the beast's red blood around the inside, leaving some clear space round the edges. A few of the small meaty globes should get in there, scattered about. Like, this is the tone of the cookbook, and I need it. all of the writing for it. Like, so it serves four not yet grown to full size. Serves four children. It's just brilliant. I love it. But you can use these kind of things as good inspiration for meals and dishes that exist in the world that might be served in various situations. And absolutely you should steal those things. And that's kind of it. That's what I got on food. I mean, really hungry now.
Yeah. I mean, there is actually a Song of Ice and Fire cookbook I know.
Mm-hmm.
That's in existence, and there's a bunch of these. There's
so many.
There's Lord of the Rings one.
Here's the thing: there are so many Lord of the Rings ones. There's a general one. There's a Hobbit specific one. An Elf specific one. Like, it just keeps going, because people go, "Hey, I know what I think that food looks like, and these people agree with me. So let's make it so that people can cook these things."
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful. Like, again, like, a big part of our communication centers around food, and that it doesn't just restrict us to just eating a meal together, but sharing those meals quite literally in, hey, I made this with, you know, my family. This is now your family recipe. This is how traditions and memories are passed down without having food going off.
Right.
The last thing I want to talk about is Goodberry wine, because Goodberry wine is something that I decided very early on should be a thing, and never kind of really sat down and put it together. So you know about the spell Goodberry.
Yes.
Goodberry is, tends to be, I think, I think people other than druids can cast it, but it's mm-hmm. very traditionally a druid spell in which you summon 12 berries that are considered magical. You eat a berry, you get one hit point, and you don't have to eat anything for the rest of the day. It's great.
It's a good berry.
It's a good berry. It's a great berry, even. No, it's not that good. And I thought, well, you could make wine out of that, which I think speaks about, you know, volumes about me that I need to unpack with my therapist. But but I thought you could absolutely make a magical item called Goodberry Wine. So I did. Goodberry Wine comes served in a bottle with 13 servings in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason for this. We'll come back to it. It is a deeply rich drink. This plum red liquid clings to glassware and almost seems to shimmer in the sunlight. With a heady scent of sweet fruits and a hint of rose, this fortified wine is often the last toast before battle or awakes bittersweet sacrifice. It is traditional to leave one glass undrunk, instead offering it to those who have already passed. The bottle would be left open overnight, and though many have tried, nobody has ever seen where the last drink goes, only that it is gone come the dawn.
Mm.
So, mechanically, a glass of Goodberry Wine imbues the drinker with 1d8 temporary hit points until the end of a next long rest or until those hit points are lost. Hit points gained through Goodberry Wine stack. However, consumption of more than 3 glasses of the substance will cause the drinker to become poisoned until the end of a long rest. If all 13 servings are consumed, all hit points granted immediately vanish.
Ah.
You gotta leave that last glass. You gotta yep. leave it. If you're tempted to drink it, nope. Poof. All the power's gone. I know that, I can't remember the source of it, but I know there is a myth around Goodberries and their creation, which is that there were 13 created, and if you eat 13, you get trapped in the Feywild.
Oh, no.
I can't remember exactly why and where this story comes from, and I'm gonna have to try and remember and try and, because I know who told me this story, and I just can't remember the details. But I've had this in my head ever since, that there's a reason that you only get 12 berries, and right. that's because if you ever get 13, you cannot eat the last berry, because you get trapped in the Feywild forever. That's just it. Because Goodberries are a Fey item.
Yeah,
it's a magical 100%. Berry. I mean, come on. You know the Fae's got something to do with it. But yeah, there you go. Goodberry Wine. Use it in your campaigns as you wish, or just pretend it never happened. That's fine too.
You do you.
You do you. I'm not your mum. Anyway, that has been episode 45 of Cannibalizing the Canon. As always, you can email us, you can tweet us, you can hop on our Discord and tell me that Goodberry Wine tastes like butts. Please don't.
Who is the true fool? The person who says something tastes like butts, or the realization that you know what butts taste like?
I mean, hey, whatever works for you, pal. You know, I'm not going to judge your tastes. But yeah, you can find all of those links in our beacon below and more, excitingly. We will be back next week with another episode. Until then, I have been V/Fella/Rin/3Dogs in a trench coat, a little bit tipsy on Goodberry Wine. Woof woof woof.
And I have been Glaive/Danny/ lacking in salmon of knowledge based diet. And until next time.
yeah, this has been Cannibalizing the Canon. Bye.
Bye.